Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, the very first day of April. Welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So today on the show, we have a man who a year ago today captured headlines after standing on the Senate floor for 25 hours and 4 minutes delivering an impassioned speech in protest of the Trump administration's policies. Senator Cory Booker, yeah, you probably guessed by that, a Democrat representing New Jersey, had an act of resistance that actually broke through the noise of the news cycle, and it inspired his latest book titled Stand. So the recently married senator is running for a third term, and he is going to be with us on the show today to talk about his new book, his career in politics, the future of the Democratic Party, what he sees as the future, as well as a whole lot more, some local news, maybe some local politics. And we, of course, would love to hear from you, our listeners. What questions or comments do you have for New Jersey Senator Cory Booker? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook streamers, you can put your comments in the chat. And I got to meet and interview Mr. Booker last week at the Free Library Foundation's author event. And it was a beautiful day. And yet that room was packed. It was sold out. So
no, there's always been a lot of interest in him for decades at this point.
Yeah.
For decades. I mean, and we might go back a little bit to the beginning of his political career.
Yeah.
Because there's some interesting stuff that came from the streets of Newark, New Jersey.
Streets of Newark.
Yeah, that's right. So what questions do you have for Senator Cory Booker? 888-477-9499. Hop on the phone or email us studio2@whyy.org. But first, a trio of local news headlines, starting with a story that broke kind of right after we went off the air yesterday. A federal judge approved the Trump administration's request to get information on Jewish faculty and staff at the University of Pennsylvania as part of a broader probe into anti-Semitism. Now, Penn has been fighting this subpoena by the EEOC that seeks personal information on people affiliated with Jewish groups on campus. The government says it needs this information because it's looking for folks who would have information or even potential victims of anti-Semitism. But many Jewish staff at Penn said this was an invasive request for personal information that could further endanger them. Now, the judge in this case dismissed those concerns and said the administration was within its rights to request contact information about employees who could have, you know, relevant information in this ongoing probe. And that judge, by the way, is an Obama appointee.
Mm-hmm.
Penn almost immediately said it's going to appeal this ruling. But the ruling, as it stands now, requires Penn to fulfill this federal government request by May 1st, which is a month from today.
Yeah, the Trump administration has said that its request was very typical for discrimination investigations. And the judge, as you mentioned, was an Obama, you know, appointee, agreed. And depending on what happens at the appeal stage, I mean, this could set a major precedent for the administration's efforts to get lists like this from other schools as well. But what stood out to me, that the judge wrote in his opinion, though, and quote, though ineptly worded, the request had an understandable purpose. And usually when you have a subpoena that is ineptly worded, you ask the government to go redo the subpoena and not just grant them what they're asking for. So that was like a little bit of a
weird. Thought that was strange.
I thought that was strange.
Well, I guess maybe he's saying it's ineptly worded, not illegally worded.
And not illegally,
like clumsily worded. I mean, you don't know exactly what the judge is thinking, but yeah.
And so that stood out to me. Also, you know, Penn has said that, you know, this is raising all sorts of First Amendment issues, you know, freedom of religion, freedom of association issues, also privacy issues. So they're going to push forward. But, you know, it just, I think there's a trust issue here. People are kind of they don't trust this administration. And I think that the administration probably needs to do more so that communities do trust them, because they have no idea what is going to, you know, eventually happen with this information.
Speaking of lists. And the Trump administration, story number two,
Cherry. Governor Josh Shapiro has vowed to protect Pennsylvania voters after President Donald Trump signed an executive order to create a national eligible voter list and to restrict mail-in voting. That executive order was signed Tuesday. It was immediately criticized by voting law experts who called it an attempt to seize state power to run elections and to promote the President Trump's claims of election fraud. Governor Shapiro spoke out just hours after that order was signed, posting on X that, quote, President Trump can sign whatever the hell he wants to, and these are his words, but it won't change the Constitution. He goes on to say, the authority to set our election rules belongs to the state, and as governor, I will protect your right to vote. That includes your right to vote by mail. This executive order, what it does is it directs the Department of Homeland Security to work with the Social Security Administration to develop what they're calling the state citizenship list, which would be compiled from several government records, including citizenship, naturalization, and a whole lot more. It would also block the U.S. Postal Service from sending absentee ballots to people not on each state's approved list. So there's a lot of questions.
That's a big trip.
And they're saying, look, expect lawsuits, right? Expect lawsuits. And it's unclear whether Pennsylvania will be part of those lawsuits. But the Shapiro administration has not been afraid to file lawsuits, to fight back against this Trump administration. And no one can forget that, you know, Governor Shapiro is running for a second term right now. Yeah. So,
and that vote is coming up pretty soon, right? Yeah. That's the other really important thing to consider. There's still so many unsettled issues around these lists, around voting, with an election coming up in a matter of months. I mean, first a primary, but then a general election. And you just hope the judiciary is ready to respond quickly, because it feels like there is like a nest of confusion still around elections, even though the pandemic is now many years in our rearview mirror, at least the beginning of it. And it still feels like there's a lot of unsettled issues. And
confusion is not good when we talk about voting. Confusion is not good, especially when there's accusations of fraud, even though there's no evidence of it. But when you add confusion in there, sure. I mean, it's a hornet's nest.
Total. And I don't think it's a partisan thing to say confusion is bad for voting. Mm-hmm. Okay, so story number three. We just got to give you guys a warning.
Uh-oh.
It's April 1st. Yes. Head on a swivel today, folks. April 1st. Lots of local businesses and organizations are going to try to trick you. For instance, I might say we're not actually interviewing Senator Cory Booker today. Ooh. We're interviewing Bory Cooker, a very dull chef. But no, we're
Bory
not, right?
Cooker. You like that's a good one. That's a good one. Cooker.
I thought I was going to get a chuckle out of you on that.
Well, you know, that was a delayed chuckle. My bad. My bad.
Okay. But a lot of folks out there are trying to trick you, not us. We're 100% serious all the time.
Yes.
Reading Terminal Market was trying to say people, you know, it's pronounced Reading Terminal Market. That, you know, come on. That wasn't
true. With a trademark sign. They thought they were going to get
us. They thought they were going to get me. Chinatown restaurant Sankey said it was starting a duck robot delivery service, but they posted that a day early. That was a little tricky. I didn't like that. Okay. I'm going to give you, Cherry, three things posted today by local businesses, but one of them is real. Mm-hmm. So it's two fools and a truth. Okay.
All right.
And see if you can figure it out.
I'm ready.
So here's the first one. The city plans to slightly widen Elfris Alley in Old City so that cars can pass two ways. That's number one. You want to comment on that?
Do you want to comment? Well, I'm looking at the picture that they have, and I know I've been down this area in Old City. It's really narrow. I don't know how they would do that.
Yeah, okay. Number two, the famed Magic Gardens on South Street will temporarily become a pool this summer. And actually, I think we have a clip for that one. Do we have a clip there? Let's play that clip.
Hey, guys. We're changing it up this year. We're going to open a pool. We're going to fill it up with water, and you can come swim every day of the week. We're hiring lifeguards, so come on down. Bring us your resume. 5 years lifeguarding experience necessary. Come on down.
Okay. Well, I love it. They have the alligator, a blue alligator floaty wrapped around them. I love it. I would like that to be true.
Yes. Okay. So you're rooting for that one.
I'm rooting for that one.
Okay. Number three, Crust Vegan Bakery is teaming up with Fishtown Pickles to create a pickled flavored Pop-Tart that they're going to serve alongside pickle lemonade. Look at that. We got a little image there. Look at that thing. Okay. So
no.
Which one of those, just a straight no, which one of those is true?
The thing I would want to be true would be Magic Gardens.
Yeah.
But the thing I think might be true is the Pop-Tart.
It is. You are correct. Maybe I didn't make that hard. Did I make that too easy?
It looked really real.
It didn't.
That Pop-Tart thing.
It is real. So apparently it did start as a joke. It started as, I think, an April Fool's joke. And then I guess they made some and people liked it. So now every year they do pickle Pop-Tarts.
But you know what? I like pickles with a lot of things, though.
So you eat the pickle Pop-Tart?
I like pickles and peanut butter, which is a weird combination. But I like salty, though.
So you would eat the pickle Pop-Tart?
I would try it.
You would try it? And yeah. The pickle lemonade?
What's the difference? That might be good. That's
basically Gatorade.
Oh, goodness. Pickle lemonade. And I don't even like Gatorade.
All right.
So anyway.
Anyways, we're just saying be careful out there, folks. And also stay tuned because we're talking to Senator Cory Booker on the other side of this break. Get your calls and comments in. This is Studio 2 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're talking to the Democratic Senior Senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker, about his new book, Stand, inspired by his record-breaking 25-hour speech on the floor of the Senate exactly 1 year ago. Today, Stand is a plea to Americans of all political persuasions to set aside their differences and re-engage in good faith politics.
Neither a memoir nor a political manifesto, Senator Booker structures this book by talking about 10 distinct virtues. In each chapter, he talks about how he came to learn the importance of virtues like humility, patriotism, and perseverance, and his teachers along the way.
Here with us today to unpack the book and where it came from is the author himself. Welcome, Senator Cory Booker. So nice to see you.
I think Bori Cooker, as you said earlier, might be that. I want to meet that chef.
Yeah, no, that could be a character, an alter ego of yours. Just think about it.
Just think about it.
If I could cook.
Well, maybe Bori Cooker is a bad cook. I mean, we'll workshop it later, okay? But we would love to, in the meantime, hear from our listeners this hour. What questions do you have for Senator Booker? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, streaming YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And Senator Booker, so great to have you here. And, you know, it's not lost on us that a year ago today, you were standing on the Senate floor, you were reading from a series of binders, and you broke through the Trump news cycle. And I want you to reflect on what you learned that day about what it takes in politics these days to get a message, to craft a message that actually reaches the people.
Well, as I say in the book, I got challenged by my own constituents in the city where people had been voting for me since 1998. And a guy said to me very determinedly, he goes, "Why aren't you Democrats doing more?" And I made excuses. And he said very pointedly, "Are you an American or an American't?" And I said, "Ha ha, I get it." And he goes, "Cory, I've been voting for you since 98. Where's the guy that took on the machine and won, that lived in a mobile home and parked it on our worst drug corners, that did a 10-day hunger strike in the projects, that actually made changes that we didn't think were possible and you made us believe?" And so he sent me back to Washington with this understanding that real power, real leadership isn't title or position, it's action and example. And if I wanted other people to stand up, I really needed to show that I could stand too, and in this case, literally. But more importantly than that, we wanted to stand and elevate the stories of other Americans, to talk about the people in communities that were facing that fear, that hurt, that outrage, and their courage to do something about it. At the end of the day, this book is inspiration and instruction. It's an answer to people asking me, what can I do? And that's why I take so many stories from our past and our present of Americans in the worst of times, showing the best of who we are.
Did you learn a lesson, though, about political communication in 2025, 2026?
Absolutely.
Because there's like a cynical read on all this that it's a stunt, but the sort of cynical reaction to the cynicism would be like, you have to do that today because the information fire hose is so complete, so severe, so constant that unless you do something that has the potential to go viral, you literally cannot reach people. I would love for you to break down what you learned about political messaging in that moment.
Well, I just want to reinforce that we think everything we're facing is new, but activists of old had the same problem. How do you garner the attention of America and then prick their moral imagination, the conscience of a country? And so remember, it was Alice Paul, the first person in U.S. history to go protest in front of the White House, gathered the whole nation's attention as she and other silent sentinels protested President Wilson and eventually converted him to their cause of suffrage. It's the woman I write about who dislodged the Americans with Disability Act from Congress, finally got it to move because a young 9-year-old girl, Jennifer Keelan Chaffins, threw herself out of her wheelchair, crawled up the Capitol steps using her elbows and her chin. It's AIDS activists who, at a time that a president was showing savage indifference to the crisis of AIDS in America, who found such creative ways, like the AIDS quilt, to force America to confront it. It's the civil rights activists who found ways, whether it was the Marches of Bloody Sunday, the Children's March in Birmingham. We are a nation that was built on ordinary Americans finding ways to break through. And now we need the same creativity. We need the same really defiant actions to get people to stop focusing. And that stand on the 1 year ago, I was standing on the floor, it was still heading towards the record. And at that point, over 300 million people on TikTok alone had liked that, had pressed like on TikTok. They reached out to us and said they had never seen anything like it. Because to me, it just reinforces the truth is that we all have to find ways of breaking out and stepping out in this time where I think our politics on both sides of the aisle is failing the moment. And this is a time for more leaders to stand up.
And I wonder what you learned from that moment, because, I mean, before that, you had been kind of quiet, I would say. Maybe some people hadn't heard from you, but that moment, everybody heard, right? And so I just wonder what it felt like to feel, did you feel more connected with the people? Because sometimes in the Senate, you're not necessarily on the streets every day. I just wonder what you learned and what it felt like to really, you know, get your message heard by so many people and have them react to you.
Yeah. So first of all, it was one of the more meaningful experiences of my life because it created deeper connection. We have never, and even the Senate people who cleared the letters that come into the United States Senate have never seen anything like it. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, not just correspondents, but young school children taking actions, doing artwork. And it was almost overwhelming to me emotionally to feel that connected with a zeitgeist that was in our country, one that I did not create, but was a part of now, of a moment where people said after months of the Trump administration, it was March to April, finally people said, you know what, we are just going to fight. And it was some kind of reminder to me about how connected we all are. Yeah. When one of us stands up, we ignite and excite other people to do the same.
So what's next then? Because I think, not to say that that's not enough, I guess it's just like if you need to do things like this to break through, and you made the argument, I think convincingly, that perhaps we've always needed to do things like this to reach people. What can you do to build on this? Because now you've done that, right? And if you do that again, people will say, well, he's doing it again. What is the next thing that builds on that 25-hour speech?
Well, a couple things. One is we're going to continue to do activities. You know, me and Hakeem Jeffries did a sit-in on the Capitol steps that garnered 100 million views. But after you did something that was so much significantly bigger than it may seem small, but it is important. You know, just taking trips and visiting detention facilities, just going out and teaching other colleagues of mine how to use social media, because United States Senate Democrats were not on the platforms that most Americans were doing. We now increased the engagement with Senate Democrats 7x online, some of my colleagues getting accounts on platforms that they never had before. I am out there on this movement, and it's not just an anti-Donald Trump movement. I'm going to fight him. I'm going to stand. I'm going to do creative things like we're doing against this war in Iran. But I'm on a bigger movement for a renewal in America, for us to redeem the dream, because so many Americans are done with politics in general. They feel like they're working harder. They can't pay back their student loans. They can't pay for their health insurance and take care of their children. We're in a moment in America where this country seems to be failing us, and we need more than left-right politics. We need to find ways to ignite a new vision for our country in the same way that there was revolutionary thinkers. The New Deal and FDR was a revolution in a moral imagination again for our country, and it was a generational shift. John F. Kennedy's years were the same thing. I think we're on the precipice of a big realignment in American politics. I demand it that we find a way to get out of this trap that seems to be failing everyone.
Real quickly, what is the big idea, though, that you can pair with something like the attention you're generating online to create not just attention, but attention attached to an idea?
Yes.
Because one thing that I wonder is if Democrats are too tepid in their policy prescriptions, and therefore they can't really capitalize when they generate attention because they can't marry it with a big idea. Like, what's the big idea you marry it to?
Yeah, so that's what I say. I think that, look, no matter what, these November elections are going to be a lot about a rejection of Donald Trump's politics. A rejection of what he's done to our country, jacking up our costs, millions losing health care, fuel, energy, food, all of these things. Americans are worse off than they were when he was elected. But you cannot capture a new American moment by talking about what you're against. You just said it has to be a vision for what you're for, and it has to be bold. And so my team and I are not waiting for the party. We're not waiting for permission. We're starting to unveil big ideas, and the two that we've done and one we're about to do. The one we've done is, like, the whole tax code reflects the kind of corruption in our country right now, where the highest earning people pay the lowest percentage of their income in taxes, while working folks like you all, like cops, firefighters, like the people that are being sent to Iran, are paying literally higher percentages on their earnings in taxes. So the first big idea is enough. We're going to unrig the tax system, get rid of all the tax avoidance that the richest of the rich use not to pay taxes. And we're going to take that savings and make an America where no one in this country pays income tax on their first $75,000 of household earnings. It would give a massive boost to Americans at all, from middle class, working class, and even it would cut child poverty in half. And so big ideas like that, we ask people to go to our website and just put in your how many kids you have and your salary, and you'll see that you're going to be earning $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 more of your money you're going to be able to keep. And it's a simple thing to deal with the biggest pain point Americans have right now, which is they cannot afford to make ends meet.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are feeling the crunch right now around affordability. But I got to ask you about, you know, you've said that the Democratic Party has sort of failed in this moment, and you've called for a new generation of leadership. And so I wanted to sort of ask you about what the face of the new Democratic Party would be. Would it be more like a James Tallarico from, you know, Texas? Would it be like an AOC or a Zahram Mamdani of New York? Like, what do you, or somebody, you know, totally in between who's able to bring all the different constituencies together? What do you see as sort of like the future, the winning message that will bring and build a coalition that could move the Democrats toward a win?
So you just said it. Yes. Is it this? And my answer is yes, yes, yes. The Democratic Party, first of all, has to understand, if you are so ideologically pure that you say, I'm only going to let people in my coalition who agree with me on everything, you're going to have a very small coalition. You need coalitions where there is areas of disagreement, but the big things we agree on. So the first thing I want to say is the Democratic Party needs to be a lot bigger, open its tent, pull more people in to start working on the things that matter. And those faces, I hope there's a lot. I hope that we are pleasantly surprised with the new kind of leaders from different lived experiences, different values, different views, but yet still share the same urgency, is that the American dream is failing more than half of our country, and that we're going to deal with that. And so I look, everybody looks to the 2020 elections, who's going to be our standard bearer? I'm looking forward to that fight, that argument. We want to have a robust primary for president, but that's not the Democratic Party. The party is so much bigger than that. It's what's happening in Philly. It's what's happening on the streets in rural towns in Iowa. We have to start being like my grandfather's generation. When the New Deal came around, they created a Democratic Party that was for factory workers and farmers, for union workers and for lawyers in Manhattan. It was suddenly a party that people could believe in America. And the dominance of the Democratic Party from my grandfather's era to the time I was born of Tip O'Neill, they held majorities in Congress all through that time because everybody believed this is the party fighting for America. Well, we have lost that. And to get that back, we need a new deal again. We need a renewal of the American dream again. That's what I'm fighting for.
But of course, someone might counter that and say one of the things that made that coalition possible is they were willing to tolerate racism within the Democratic Party. I mean, there was a Southern Democratic wing that was openly segregationist. Like, we talk about getting rid of purity tests. On what issues? Like, what issues are you willing to bend and what issues are you not willing to bend?
Well, my grandfather was a black guy who was a Republican, as most blacks were before the Great Depression. And my grandfather just said, look, I'm going to become a Democrat because this is the party of Medicaid and Medicare. Mm. It's the party of union rights and the party of civil rights. So there was principles that they stood for that spoke to all of Americans, and they made their case. Remember, this was a time of expansive immigration because folks knew that immigrants don't take jobs. They create more of them. And so, of course, there has to be core bedrock principles and values that are not Democratic Party values. I think they need to be American values. It's just like Martin Luther King, who stood up on the March on Washington and didn't unfurl his list of grievances, or he didn't say, I have a 14-point policy plan. He stood up and gave a morally based vision of America that was so inclusive that over 80% of America could say, yeah, that's right. Sure, there was 20% of white segregationists and supremacists in the South that said, screw that guy. But most of America are good folks who want the same things. And that's the kind of vision we need right now.
And I got to ask you, Senator Booker, because in the fall, the Democrats had captured the American people's attention during the first shutdown and held it down. People were finally waking up. They felt like the Democrats were finally winning and the Senate was taking the lead. And then all of a sudden they give in. And I just want your thoughts on that, because, yeah, you know, they finally had built this coalition around this big idea and they were building this fight. And then they didn't have the backbone to see it through. Do you think that Democrats have the type of backbone it takes to take a big idea all the way to the finish line?
Yeah, look, I was furious with that as well. As one of the Democrats that voted to stand strong, and we didn't do it. But I'm not going to turn all my anger and ire towards Democrats. I'm going to keep us focused. That was the last play. I'm a former football player, so that was our last play. We need to get our butts back in the huddle and run the next play. And that's what we're missing. We're so interested in litigating those past events. Now, look, again, we're heading towards a point where we are going to elect new leadership. This is the last baby boomer president, the last baby boomer heads of the Senate. And I want to see a new wave of leadership that has a different determination and a different fight and could hold us together. But again, I am not going to fight in my huddle. I used to know when we were going to score a touchdown when I heard the other huddle, the defensive huddle, arguing amongst each other, blaming each other. I used to tell my huddle, we're going to score on this next play because they are not united in their fight. So again, right now we need to get our butts back in the huddle and run the next play. And even that loss, I thought it was a loss. I thought it was the wrong play. But headlines from the New York Times to the Washington Post said the same thing. Democrats lost this battle, but they're going to win the war because every American now knows that the healthcare nightmare of America belongs to the Republicans. They held the line on healthcare long enough to make people understand clearly the Republicans want to cut the Affordable Care Act subsidies, $1 trillion from Medicaid. They're going to wreck rural hospitals and clinics. So again, I think we lost that battle. But the bigger war we're fighting to make every American have affordable health care, quality health care, I think that battle now is giving us momentum to the larger goals that we seek. Mm.
A comment here from Judith, who says, Cory Booker is decent, kind, cares about doing the right thing for the American people. I would be honored to have him as president of the United States. Maybe we'll bookmark that for later. But I wanted to read a quote from your book. Again and again, our shared story shows us that great change doesn't come from Washington. It comes to Washington from Americans who realize their agency and take small but definitive, determined actions against the wrongs they see. And I think one of my questions is, what's the signal coming from America right now that might force you to reconsider some of your prior positions? And a lot of people, I have to say, in the comments are asking about Israel specifically. Catherine, for instance, from Allentown says, you've supported military aid to Israel with votes in Congress. In 2025, our aid to Israel was over $12.5 billion. Is it time to rethink our relationship to the current Israeli government? Are you getting a signal from America that they see a wrong here and that you need to move on this issue?
Well, first of all, I think that you're misconstruing my views. First of all, the last part of her question is 100% right on. This Netanyahu government, I put them in the same camp as the Donald Trump government. They are god-awful. I lead in the United States Senate right now, literally calling for sanctions against Israeli settlers who are doing so much violence in the West Bank right now. My record will continue to be fighting against the forces like Netanyahu, who are caring about things that to me are horrific, and defending the indefensible. But I will support the state of Israel, as with the Jordanian people and other allies we have in that region, because I believe in those countries. Now, I also believe there should be a Palestinian state, and I think the Palestinians deserve fundamental justice. And the death of Palestinian children ache me as much as the death of Israeli children. That nightmare must come to the end. But here's what most people need to understand. There will never be Palestinian security and an autonomous state unless there's Israeli security. There will never be Israeli security unless there's Palestinian justice and an independent state. These two groups who have had so much conflict are deeply and intimately tied together in destiny. The only way we're going to get to this is to find a way to assure Israeli security and an autonomous Palestinian state. And my politics in the Senate have been very focused on working to that end.
Yeah. Do you believe you've moved on that issue, though, at all? And maybe that's just in response to the Netanyahu government and the way that they've shifted. But I guess what Catherine was asking, is it time to rethink our relationship? And I'm curious if you have rethought in sort of light of what's happened over the last three to four years at this point.
The horrors in Israel and Gaza and the West Bank have commanded my focus since I got to the Senate and before. Every trip I've taken to Israel, I've tried to meet with Palestinian leaders to talk about the urgency. In fact, I was in Israel on October 7th, sent there. I just saw McGurk, who was one of the chief negotiators for the Biden administration, who they sent me over there to try to fast forward this deal with the Saudis that would have assured an irrevocable path towards a two-state solution. And it was all scuttled by a horrific terrorist organization who does not want peace in the region and justice. So I am always moved by what's going on there and continue to do my best to play whatever role I can in alleviating the suffering of Palestinians. My office, to the credit of a lot of my team members, have helped to get doctors into Gaza, helped to get children out. We've always tried to position ourselves so that we can do the most justice today and then work to that longer-term solution tomorrow. And I want to say this because what also bothers me is, as much as we must be focused on justice in that region, there are so many other places in this world where there's horrific things that go on that have a painful indifference in this country. The biggest humanitarian crisis on our country, another place that I've been to that right now is facing horrors, is Sudan. And we are playing a role. American weapons are ending up in that conflict, and we, to me, are not doing enough to stop that as well. So again, my focus is alleviating the cost crisis here at home, the larger protection and advancement of our democracy, so the American dream is in reach of everyone, But I am a global citizen and will do everything I can as an American to bring peace, justice, and security to other nations in the world that are in crisis.
And we'll leave it right there because we're going to take a break. What are your questions for Senator Cory Booker? Give us a call at 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. We'll get to some of those questions on the other side of the break. This is Studio 2. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're talking with New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. He has a new book out, Stand, which is a call to Americans to step up and make a difference. Senator Booker lays out key virtues that can help guide people in their fight for change, things like humility, patriotism, agency, vision. And we're also talking about his life as well as national and, of course, New Jersey politics.
We'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have for Senator Cory Booker? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. And we have a caller on the line right now. This is Angela from Valley Forge, and Angela's been holding a while. We appreciate that. Angela, you're on Studio 2. What is your question for the senator?
Well, first I want to say congratulations to your for your marriage, Senator Booker.
Thank you.
My first question is, what is Congress, or you specifically going to do about the DOGE breach of Social Security platforms and data? And do you want my second question?
Sure, if you
go
can
ahead,
make it
put
brief,
it on in there, yeah.
Okay, and secondly, what is the relationship of Palantir to the drive by the federal government to obtain state voter rolls?
Palantir is contracts with the federal government, and so I just want to clarify that. Go ahead.
No, Angela, I love that you're a watchdog on this, because I think this is we're experiencing right now one of the greatest breaches of Americans' privacy that we've ever seen. The DOGE folks were given utterly unfettered access to some of the most private data of Americans, from their Social Security to even potentially some of their health data. And this should be alarming to everyone. And the fight that we have, and this is why this coming election to get control back of the House and the Senate, is we can't even get hearings on the work of DOGE and the ongoing efforts of the Trump administration to continue to scrape our private data. Remember, this most recent SAVE Act, people are saying it's about voter ID. It's not. It's about the federalizing of our elections and the taking of our election data to the federal government for purposes that are not clear, especially when the Constitution lays it plain that elections are to be done by the states. And so what I'm hoping to do, you say what we're fighting, is we're trying to put them on notice, asking the questions, making sure agencies are put on notice to retain the documentation of the things that they've scraped. And my hope is that after November, we will have the power to launch investigations into these breaches of American privacy and bring to light all the things that they've been doing in darkness that violate not just Democrats, but violate all Americans who treasure one of the biggest ideals of our country, which is the right to privacy.
Yeah, and you mentioned investigations. I wonder, you know, to the extent that Democrats are able to arrest the majority when the midterms come, what would be the top three priorities? You mentioned this investigations, but what would be the big focus if the Democrats get that majority?
Well, again, I know there's leaders in Congress, so I want to speak for this one Democrat about what my priorities are. If we hold both houses, the first and foremost thing we should do is to show and expose the deep, crushing corruption that is undermining the public interest right now. This is a president who is letting the massive fraudsters of the American people, people that are driving up our costs, get out scot-free and allowing a lot of things that go on that are making it harder for Americans to make ends meet. Even just the mergers that Donald Trump is pushing to approve are going to drive up our costs. And those folks now don't believe they have to get approval from an outside regulatory agency. All they need to do is contribute to Donald Trump's ballroom or give money to his cryptocurrencies. The second thing we've got to do is hit that nail on the head. Corruption will help stop the rising costs, but there has got to be legislation that we push to a desk and make him veto if he's going to veto it, but maybe pressure him to pass it, that actually addresses the cost crisis for this country, whether it's health care and the fact that millions are losing health care, or as simple as taking on his chaotic tariffs that have driven so many American businesses and small businesses out of business.
I'm curious if maybe this has changed since you got to Washington at this point, you know, over a dozen years ago. Sort of the personal relationships among politicians and your faith that the other side operates in good faith. Because you start the book with this anecdote. It's the eve of Superstorm Sandy. At this point, you're the mayor of Newark, New Jersey. And you get back-to-back kind of courtesy calls from President Obama and then Governor Chris Christie. And I think one of the messages conveyed there is that, like, even if people disagreed publicly behind the scenes, they're cordial, they work together. Like, has that changed since you've been in Washington? Can you still have, like, we don't know what goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Like, can you, do you still, can you still talk to a majority of Republican senators and have those types of calls? Or is that, like, dead and gone?
Yeah, so much of the biggest things I've gotten done in Congress were based upon relationships and outreach I have with my colleagues across the aisle. And I am never going to close doors. As long as you can keep threads of connection, personal connection or what have you, you create pathways to get stuff done. Remember, New Jersey didn't send me to Washington to be a great Democratic senator. They sent me to Washington to be a great senator for New Jersey. And in the 6 years I've been in office, this last 6 years, we've been able to bring back more federal dollars to the state of New Jersey than ever before. And it's been happened because of my relationships with Republicans, even most recently getting congressionally directed funding for specific projects all across my state was done because I have relationships with people like Susan Collins and others. But you're asking a very important question, because I am very frustrated, more than I've ever been, with my Republican colleagues in the Senate, because they are enabling Donald Trump by not doing their job. The job of the Senate is to hold hearings. We haven't had one open hearing on the war. It's to check and balance. We're not checking this president's abuse of our war powers, our spending powers, and it's ultimately to hold him to account. If he is violating his oath, is he violating the rights of Americans, if he is jacking up people's prices, if he is taking away power from other branches, if he's threatening federal judges, it's the job of Congress to hold him accountable for his egregious actions, and we have failed every time because Republicans refuse to stand up.
Yeah, Kurt says, I'm disgusted by the continual insults and whining of the Republican Party and their attacks on Democrats using baseless claims. Why don't Democrats get angry and more aggressive, asked Kurt. That seems to be all the right understands at the moment. And so, you know, I just want to, you know, you talked about the relationships that you have with your Republican colleagues and how that has been instrumental in what you're able to do for your state. But I wonder, like, talk about the type of fight. Some people are saying, look, Democrats have been too nice. They don't fight back. They need to fight fire with fire. You know, you see what the you know, Republicans put on even the White House Instagram, you know, account.
Yep.
And Democrats are tepid in their response. They're not willing to get dirty. What do you say in response to people like Kurt, who says, you know what, Democrats, Cory Booker, you're too nice. You're not fighting hard enough.
Well, again, I'm grateful that I've had a long history in politics, including an Oscar-nominated documentary about me called Street Fight. it lost in the Oscars, by the way, to March of the Damn Penguins. But
there you
it
go.
Was an Oscar-nominated movie about me battling it out in an inner city to make transformative change in my hometown of Newark. And in Washington, first of all, I have never been this angry. I cannot remember a time in politics where I'm more angry. But anger doesn't mean that you double down on darkness. This is not about being nice. Nobody wants nice. The people who are nice to me in a moment like this, that niceness is saccharine and frankly, ineffective. What is effective, though, is fighting hard, but fighting the right way. So, example, if they're going to redistrict Texas, damn well we should be redistricting California and stop them from cheating and making sure that we're protecting ourselves. But what it doesn't mean is when they lie and cheat and even steal, that we mirror those violations of the very virtues and ideals of our country. And what does that mean? Well, Martin Luther King did not bring bigger dogs and bigger fire hoses to fight Bull Connor. He didn't double down on the darkness and the hate. What he did do, though, is through his principled and noble stand. Nobody's going to say those kids that were standing in front of fire hoses and standing up dark to dogs were weak. It was one of the strongest fights in the civil rights movement, and it shocked this country and got thousands of people off of their backsides and to get into the fight as well. In fact, there was no more rental cars left at the airport. So many people were flying in to help these noble fighters. So many people are sick and tired of politics as usual, where people are just screaming and yelling at each other and nothing gets done. The real problem, what we have to repent for in this moment, is not what the Republicans are doing. King said it in his time. He said, what we have to repent for is not just the vitriolic words and violent actions of the bad people, it's the appalling silence and inaction of the good people. We have got to fight in a way that we win, and we win by getting more people off their couches and into this fight as well. And that's really what is the balance we've got to do. Get angry, but let your anger get you to be more of an activist. Make your outrage get you out working. You can't just sit on the sidelines and boo what's happening on the field. You need to join folks, because democracy is not a spectator sport.
And by the way, Gary did ask, what can you say to help citizens overcome their fear of participating in nonviolent resistance? I think you might have just answered that one. So thank you for that question, Gary.
If you're not afraid right now, I don't know what to say to you. Courage is not the absence of fear. It's having great fear and acting anyway.
Yep.
Hope is not the absence of despair. Great hope means that you're confronting the greatness of despair, and you're not going to let that despair have the last word. If you're not brokenhearted, if America hasn't broken your heart, I'm sorry, you don't love her enough. There is bad stuff happening all over our nation, and as we talked earlier, all over the world. And the question is not what other people are going to do. We are the heroes we need right now. All of us. We have to stand up and do more in this moral moment in America than we were doing last month or last year.
I can't let you get out of here without asking a question about Newark. And you mentioned 1998. Earlier in our conversation, when you first ran for city council. And, you know, I went back and looked at some of the articles written in 1998 about you. And I found a quote that I think resurfaces
Avi
from time.
Avi with the deep cuts. Yeah. Avi with the deep cuts.
Yeah, always goes deep.
You told, I think this might have been the first ever profile written about you in the Newark Star-Ledger. You said, quote, "I'm the most ambitious person you'd ever meet." And I feel like you don't back off of that. Like you would stand by that today. You wouldn't look at a 20-something Cory Booker and say, "Oh my God, how arrogant." You would say, "No, I stand by that. I'm still that guy." Am I right about that? You would stand by that.
Well,
quote?
Well, the rest of the quote, people usually leave off the rest of the quote. It was basically, "I'm ambitious enough to believe that this city does not have to tolerate what's going on. I'm ambitious to see a Newark where every kid can have a great public school. I'm ambitious enough to believe that this city should not have more than a third of its people living in poverty." And so my ambition wasn't for personal success. It was a quote about we all need to have a bolder, more ambitious vision of our communities, of our cities, of our country. And so, yeah, my mom asked me when I was in law school. She said to me, when I told her I didn't know what I wanted to do after law school, she asked me this question that now sits on my Senate desk. It is such an important, life-changing question to me. She asked me, "Corey, I want you to make your decisions in life out of faith and not fear. And so answer me this. What would you do with your one short life? What would you do if you knew you couldn't fail?" And I didn't have an answer for her. And then I wrote down a list of the people who most inspired me, who I would most like to be with, like when I grew up. And they were Bryan Stevenson and Marion Wright Edelman. None of them were elected leaders, but all of them were these heroic people. And finally, when I met a guy named Jeffrey Canada, who ran a massive nonprofit in Harlem that did such transformative things, that's what made me move onto a tough street in Newark and start my career as a young lawyer fighting for the community. And the best way to make God laugh is to make plans for yourself, because that 20-something-year-old kid on the street I still live off of, if they could look at the contributions I'm making right now, I hope and believe that he would look at the work that I'm doing as worthy, in a still great cause of our country.
One quick follow-up about that 98 race. I also found that you ran some ads that just said, "Cory Booker wants to talk with every voter in the Central Ward.
Yes.
Call him." And it was your number. And you really built your early career on that type of retail politics, people could reach out to you. Does that actually translate when you're trying to make national change?
It's much harder. God, I miss the days where you literally, we knocked on thousands and thousands of doors and had intimate conversations. My mother said, go meet everybody, because who you are speaks so loudly, people can't hear what you say. I think you know, Sherry and I just, when Sherry came, I met her and I felt her as much as I heard her. And that kind of connection, which is a, you know, online creates this faux sense of community, this counterfeit community. Nothing is as powerful as being out. That's why I love the No Kings mark, being in community with people, being connected. So how do you do it on a national level? I think you don't do it in little 30-second sound bites. I don't think you do it where people try to clip what you say and make you. No, I think it's deeper conversations like this. I think I tell my Senate colleagues who I push to get more engaged online, I said, you need to be authentic as possible. Let people see your faults and foibles as much as your triumphs and vision. And it's a lot of reason why I wrote this book, Stand. It is stories of Americans who inspire and instruct me, but a lot of the stories are my faults and foibles and failings as I wrestled with some of the greatest virtues in our country. So on a national level, I don't want a leader that stands up anymore and says, only I can solve your problems. I have all the answers. I know more than the generals. That kind of brash, venal braggadociousness, mendaciousness, is not what we need from leadership. We need real people who stand up and are not afraid to show their scars, their wounds, and their work still to be done, but to say, I am with you in community, I am with you in cause, and we are still a nation that stands for a higher purpose, and we can get there together. We together can honor our ancestors by doing things that others think are impossible.
Well,
there it is.
There it is. Senator Cory Booker from the great state of New Jersey, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2. The book is called
Avi
Stand.
Cherry, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk with you for a little bit.
Thank you so much. And thanks so much to Lester, Evan, Barbara, Susan, Anthony, and Hannah. I'm so sorry we could not get to your calls. Thank you to everybody who wrote in. Hopefully we covered many of your questions. And of course, we got to say thank you to Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan, our producers, Tina Calique, and Al Banks engineered today's show. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.